Yate, she Nelson Bates, Yin and She, Twahiglini, Dot, or Kosha Bashachin, Twahiglini Dashache, Alo, Tachini Dashanella. Hello, my name is Nelson Bates. I am born for the Water Flows Together clan. My father's clan is the Bitterwater people as well. My grandparents, my grandpa's clan is the Water Flows Together clan as well. And my paternal parents, my paternal grandparents' clan is the people walking into the water. I'm full Native American, I'm Navajo. I'm the only Navajo student here at Calvin. And welcome to the January series. I'd just like to start us off with a quick word of prayer. Dear God, thank you for this wonderful time that we can come together and learn about other cultures and understand how you brought us into our world and how you presented to our, how you presented yourself to us as Navajo people, as everyone in our world. And I just like to say thank you and bless everyone here and let everyone have a good day and let all those in the world who need to be blessed be blessed. In Jesus' name, amen.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the 30th anniversary of the January series. My name is Michelle Lloyd Page, and I am the Executive Associate to the President for Diversity and Inclusion. And it is my pleasure to come before you this afternoon this evening, but it's not quite evening, even though the stars are out. It's my pleasure to come before you to introduce our speaker for this afternoon. Our speaker is Mark Charles, and he is a writer, an advocate, and a consultant. You should know that he now lives in Washington, D.C., but he has lived on the Navajo Reservation. He has a passion for seeking not only to help himself to better understand our history, but to invite others along on a journey of understanding, an understanding of the complexities of American history and that intersectionality of history, of race, culture, and faith. He does this so that together we can forge a path of healing and conciliation so that one day we can be a nation that talks about reconciliation. He is a correspondent and a regular columnist for the Native News Online, and he is the author of the popular blog, Reflections from the Hogan. He serves on the board of Christian Community Development Association and consults with Calvin's Institute for Christian Worship. And he is a founding partner of the National Conference for Native Students called Would Jesus Eat Fry Bread? This is something that I appreciate about Mark. There's a lot of things that you can read about him, but what I truly admire about Mark is that he invites other people to come onto an uncomfortable journey, but he doesn't just send you on that journey and say, you deal with it. He comes alongside and he sits with you so that together we can cry, together we can grow, together we can learn. That's what I appreciate about Mark. At the conclusion of today's presentation, Mark will be available to greet audience members in the west lobby of this building. Calvin College is grateful to the friends of the January series for underwriting today's presentation. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mark Charles.
Yate. Yate. Mark Charles, Yenisha. Tsin Bake Dinan Nishlin, Doto Higlini Bashachin. Tsin Bake Dinan Bashache, Doto Dachitni Bashanella. In the Navajo culture, when you introduce yourself, you always give your four clans. We're a matrilineal people, and so when we introduce ourselves, we give our identities come from our mother's mother. So my mother's mother, as many of you know, is actually American of Dutch heritage. And so when I introduce myself, I say Tsin Bake Dine'e, which translated means the wooden shoe people. My father's mother, my second clan, is Toa Higlini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Tsinbeke Dene. And then my fourth clan, my father's father, is Totochitni. That's the Bitterwater people, one of the original clans of our Navajo tribe. It is an honor for me to be here with you today to talk about race, trauma, and the doctrine of discovery. There are many, I've given this talk in many different forms and shapes over the last several years, and I could almost name this talk, What We Don't Talk About. Because as Americans, we actually have a very long list of things we don't talk about. Now, I have to warn you, in the next 45 minutes, I am going to say some things that are going to shock you. I am going to say some things that are going to offend you. I am going to say some things that you've never heard. I'm going to teach you some history you've never heard before. At different points in this presentation, you will probably want to walk out or to throw something at me. I encourage you not to do those things. I instead invite you to stay in the dialogue, to stay engaged. We will get to a better place, but we have to get through some very uncomfortable list of things that we as a nation and as a church don't know how to talk about. One of the things we don't know how to talk about is Terrence Crutcher, this African-American man who was shot by police a few months ago. Publicly, we don't know how to talk about that. We don't know how to talk about this young man who just a few days ago on Facebook Live was attacked, possibly in a racially motivated hate crime. He was white and his attackers were not. We don't know how to talk about Colin Kaepernick, successful NFL player who on the largest stage in our nation, which is the NFL, every time he hears our song, he takes a knee. We're used to having the angry black man, or we're used to having the black man who affirms our nation is great. We don't know what to do with a successful black man who very articulately and quietly and peacefully is protesting that there are some deep problems with the history and the foundations of our country. We don't know how to talk about the Dakota Access Pipeline, this pipeline that's being built from North Dakota down to Illinois, and is gathering the largest group of Native Americans in solidarity, over 200 tribes, tens of thousands of people coming together to protest and tell our nation that water is life and you can't drink oil. We don't know how to talk about that. We also don't know how to talk about here in Western Michigan, the Potawatomi. The Potawatomi were the people who were ethnically cleansed from this land so that Grand Rapids could be built. And after the Treaty of Chicago in 1833, they were moved forcibly down to Oklahoma and other parts of the country so that white settlers could move into this land and create this place. We don't know how to talk about these things. And the reason we don't know how to talk about these things is because we don't know how to talk about our history, both our history as a church as well as our history as a nation. So I want to go all the way back to the first century. In the first century, we had the church on one side and we had the empire on the other. When you became a member of the church through your baptism, your confession, your discipleship, and your community, you knew that you stood in opposition to the empire. You knew that there was a good chance because of your belief, because of your faith, because of your membership in the church, you were going to be persecuted and possibly even killed by the empire. Now, in the third century, in the fourth century, something changed. Constantine was emperor of Rome, and while he was emperor, he became a Christian. And he was so enthralled by this that he decided to Christianize Rome. Now, this was never the notion of Jesus. Jesus was very adamant. He was not here on this earth to create a Christian empire. When Satan tempted him and said, "Bow to me and I will give you the nations of the world," Jesus said no. When the people came to him after feeding the 4,000 and tried to take him by force and make him king, Jesus said no. When Jesus was before Pilate and he said, "Don't you know I have the authority to kill you?" Jesus said, "You only have the authority my Father gave you. And if my kingdom were of this earth, my servants would come and help me. But my kingdom is of another place." Jesus never came to establish a Christian empire. He came to plant a church. He came to begin a community. He came to reveal God and himself through to the world through a church, not a political entity. And so in the fourth century, Constantine created something that Jesus and the early church fathers were adamantly against, which was a Christian empire that never existed in the writings of the New Testament. That notion was not there. And in creating this Christian empire, he nearly destroyed the understanding of what the church was. Because now, instead of joining the church through your baptism, your discipleship, your confession, and your community, now you became a member of the church through your citizenship in the empire. So in the next few hundred years, we began to have some problems. Because the empire began doing what empires do, which is expand and protect themselves through war. Well, the plain text reading of Jesus' teachings and of the teachings of Paul don't allow you to go out and begin killing on behalf of your Lord. So we needed someone to come out and do some theological gymnastics to justify why this Christian empire was behaving like the empires of the world. And we came up, thanks to St. Augustine, with a just war theory. Over the centuries, the just war theory morphed into the Crusades. The Crusades were about expanding the empire as well as protecting Jerusalem. In the 13th century, we see in the writings of the papal bulls the identification of a new class of people called the infidel. The infidel was originally meant to refer to the Moors or to the Muslims. It was later applied to indigenous peoples, people who did not worship the God of the Christian church. And we created this class of infidels, this subhuman category of people. Now, this creation changed the justification for war, because now, instead of going to war because of a just war theory, now you could go to war based on your theological grounds. You were fighting the other. You were fighting the infidel. You were fighting this other entity, this subhuman category of people. And so it's out of this understanding of what's going on in the 13th century that in the 1400s, we have the writings of the papal bulls saying things like invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever. Reduce their persons to perpetual slavery. Convert them to his and their use and profit. This papal bull, along with other papal bulls written between 1452 and 1493, collectively became known as what we call the Doctrine of Discovery. The Doctrine of Discovery is essentially the church in Europe saying to the nations of Europe, wherever you go, whatever land you find not ruled by Christian rulers, those people are less than human, and the land's yours for the taking. This was literally the doctrine that allowed European nations to go into Africa, colonize the continent, and enslave the African people. They weren't fully human. This was the same doctrine that let Christopher Columbus, who was lost at sea, land in this new world that was already inhabited by millions and claimed to have discovered it. If you think about it, you cannot discover lands that are already inhabited. If you don't believe me, leave your cell phones, your purses, your car keys out in front of you. I'll come by and discover them for you. That's not discovery, that's stealing. It's conquering. It's colonizing. Because to this day we refer to what Christopher Columbus did as discovery, it reveals the implicit racial bias of our nation, which is that people of color, Native Americans, are not fully human. This makes the doctrine of discovery a systemically racist doctrine that assumes the dehumanization of people of color. Now, the challenge with this doctrine is that over the years, it became embedded in the foundations of our nation. So in 1763, King George drew a line down the Appalachian Mountains, and he said to the colonists that they no longer had the right of discovery of the empty Indian lands west of Appalachia. This upset the colonists. They wanted access to those lands. So a few years later, they wrote a letter of protest. In their letter of protest, they accused the king of raising the conditions of new appropriations of land. They went on in their letter to state that he has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages. They signed their letter on July 4th, 1776. Literally 30 lines below the statement, "All men are created equal," the Declaration of Independence refers to natives as merciless Indian savages, making it very clear the only reason our founding fathers used the inclusive term "all men" is because they had a very narrow definition of who was and who was not human. This, of course, makes our Declaration of Independence a racist document that assumes the dehumanization of people of color. Now, a few years later, our founding fathers wrote another document. They begin this document with the words, "We the people, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility." This, of course, is the preamble to the Constitution of the United States of America. However, in Article 1, Section 2, the section of the Constitution that determines who is and who is not included, who is and who is not covered by this Constitution, A, it never mentions women, it specifically excludes natives, and it counts black people as 3/5 of a person. So, literally, the Constitution was written to protect white landowning men. We have to stop for a minute and pause and wrap our heads around that. The purpose of the Constitution, as it was written, was to protect white landowning men. We act surprised today that women earn 70 cents to the dollar. This shouldn't shock us. The Constitution's working. We act surprised today that our prisons are filled with people of color. This shouldn't shock us. The Constitution's working. We act outraged that in 2010, the United States Supreme Court sided with Citizens United and ruled that corporations now have the same rights to political free speech as individuals, creating an open door for super PACs and unlimited donations to political campaigns. This should not shock us. The Constitution is doing exactly what it was designed to do. It is protecting the interests of white landowning men. Now, maybe you're thinking, wait, didn't we correct that? Well, about 100 years later, we passed the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was meant to address Article 1, Section 2. It was meant to extend the right of citizenship to anyone born on this continent under the jurisdiction of the government. However, it did not give women the right to vote. They were still excluded. It did not include natives. We were still excluded. And even though it gave some rights of citizenship to a few former slaves, we cannot forget that Jim Crow laws were written after the 14th Amendment, that segregation was enacted after the 14th Amendment, that internment camps were enacted after the 14th Amendment. And we cannot forget that in 1970, we used the 14th Amendment in Roe versus Wade. And now we concluded that unborn babies aren't human, and therefore they can be aborted. The problem we have is our Constitution does not have a value for life. The value of the Constitution is for exploitation and profit, and the practice of the Constitution is dehumanization. This makes the Constitution of the United States a systemically racist document that assumes the white landowning male has the authority to determine who is and who is not human. A few years later, in 1823, there was a Supreme Court case, Johnson versus McIntosh. This is two men of European descent. They're litigating over a single piece of land. One of them got the land from a native tribe. The other one got the land from the government. They want to know who owned it. The case goes all the way to the Supreme Court. The court had to decide the principle upon which land titles were based. They concluded the principle was that discovery gave title to the government by whose subject or by whose authority it was made against all other European governments, and that title might be consummated by possession. They went on to use the doctrine of discovery to determine that natives who were here first but are less than human, we only have the right of occupancy to land, like a fish occupies water or a bird occupies air, and Europeans have the right of discovery to the land, and therefore they have the true title to it. This precedent by the Marshall Court, along with a few other cases during that era, created the legal precedent for land titles. This precedent and the doctrine of discovery were referenced by the Supreme Court as recently as 2005. This, of course, makes the United States Supreme Court a systemically racist court that to this day has legal precedent based on the dehumanization of people of color. Now, initially, the Protestant Church pushed back against the doctrine. This was the Catholic doctrine. They didn't fully buy into it. In 1630, John Winthrop was in the Boston Harbor with a group of colonists ready to plant the Boston colony. On this boat, he preached a sermon, and in his sermon, it was called A Mall of Christian Charity, he referred to the colonists, he compared them to a city on a hill. Now, he's borrowing from the image of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, where he told his disciples to be a lamp on a stand, a city on a hill, shining their good deeds into this dark world. John goes on in his sermon to exhort the church in all meekness, gentleness, patience, and liberality, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. These are good, basic Christian exhortations. At the end of his sermon, he begins to motivate them by quoting from Deuteronomy chapter 30. Now, Deuteronomy chapter 30 is the point in the scriptures where the people of Israel are standing at the banks of the Jordan River, about ready to take possession of their promised lands, and God is reiterating the threats and promises of his land covenant to them. If you obey me, I will do these things for you. If you disobey me, I will do these things to you. And in that passage, it says, but if our hearts shall turn away so that we will not obey and worship other gods, we shall surely perish out of the good land, whether we pass over. Now, Deuteronomy 30 says river, but in his sermon, John Winthrop says vast sea. Why does he say vast sea? Well, because he didn't cross a river, he crossed an ocean. So what is he implying? Based on the teachings of Jesus to be a city on a hill, and based on the model of Old Testament Israel, they are standing at the banks of their promised land, about ready to go and take possession of it. Now, who here has read the book of Joshua? What is God's command to the people of Joshua, or to the people of Israel in the book of Joshua? To kill everybody. What's Israel's sin in the book of Joshua? They don't kill everybody. Promised lands for one people is literally God-ordained genocide for another. I call this sermon the birth of American exceptionalism. This idea percolates for about 100 years. Middle of the 1700s, we begin expanding westward. We go past the Appalachian Mountains. We go past the Mississippi River. As we're expanding west, the Second Great Awakening begins happening. There's this renewal of churches, a growth of denominations. There's this religious fervor as our settlers are moving further and further west. And it's in the early 1800s that the term manifest destiny is coined. This belief that this nation of settlers, of immigrants, had the God-given right to rule this continent from sea to shining sea. So now that we have a systemically racist doctrine of discovery, a racist Declaration of Independence, a racist Constitution, a racist Supreme Court, and a God-ordained right to commit genocide, now we have a bunch of history we've never talked about. I want you to think about the 19th century. About a year ago, I did some research and I looked at every year of our nation from 1775 to 2016. And I put in blue every year I found our nation was in a declared state of war or armed military conflict against another nation or entity. I then put in red every year that we were fighting against Native peoples. If you look at the 19th century, for almost the entire century, and for 75 straight years, we were in a continuous state of war against the indigenous peoples of the land. The list of wars below are primarily the wars we fought against natives in the 19th century. It was during the 19th century. This is the century that we refer to in our history books as our century of expansion. This was the century we added almost 30 new states to our union. Well, clearly this was not a century of expansion. This was a century of ethnic cleansing and genocide. It was during this century that we passed the Indian Removal Act, the act of Congress that in practice gave the military the right to forcibly remove tribes from their lands in the east to empty lands further in the west. This resulted in the Trail of Tears for the Cherokee, the Chickasaw, the Choctaw. This resulted in the Long Walk for the Navajo, as we were ethnically cleansed from the southwest. All told, about a dozen tribes experienced forced relocations because of the passing of this act, and tens of thousands of Native peoples died as a direct result of the passage of this act. In 1864, we had the Sand Creek Massacre. We had about 150 to 200 Cheyenne and Arapaho men, women, and children. They're encamped over a hillside in Colorado. They're waving a white flag of surrender and an American flag to show they're there peacefully. And a U.S. Army led by a Methodist minister comes over the hill and he orders all of them slaughtered. Later, it's reported that their genitalia were paraded down the streets of Denver. In 1879, we had the Indian boarding schools begin. This was the practice our nation had of forcibly assimilating Native Americans to Western European culture. Children were taken from their homes. They were put in these military-style boarding schools. They were punished for speaking their languages. They were punished for practicing their culture. The stories of abuse, sexual, physical, mental, that come out of these schools are horrible. We also cannot forget that the Christian Reformed Church ran one such boarding school that began in the early 1900s and stayed a boarding school until the 1970s and 80s. The stated goal of these schools, the Carlisle Indian School, which was the first school in the late 1800s, the stated goal of these schools was to kill the Indian to save the man. In 1887, we passed the Dawes Act. This was an act that after we had already cleared the land through the Indian removal, we still wanted to open up more lands for white settlers. And so the Dawes Act, what it did is it allotted 160 acres of land to every male native over the age of 18. The rest of the land was then opened up to white settlement. This reduced native land holdings by about two-thirds. A landmass roughly the size of California was eventually taken from Native peoples through the passage of the Dawes Act. In 1890, we had the massacre at Wounded Knee. We know a bit more about this from our history books. We teach it a little more commonly in our schools and classrooms. This was one of the last massacres of Native peoples. It happened in 1890 where about 300 Native warriors were massacred in a single day at Wounded Knee. What we don't talk about normally is that the United States Congress gave 20 Congressional Medals of Honor to the U.S. soldiers who participated in this massacre, and that every effort to have these medals rescinded has failed. On December 19, 2009, Congress passed House Resolution 3326. This is the 2010 Department of Defense Appropriations Act, a bill laying out the appropriations for the DOD for 2010, 67-page bill. Page 45, subsection 8113, is titled Apology to Native Peoples of the United States. What follows is the seven-bullet-point apology. It mentions no specific tribe, no specific treaty, and no specific injustice. It basically says you had some nice land, our citizens didn't take it very politely, let's just call it all of our land and steward it together. And then it ends with a disclaimer that says nothing in here is legally binding. To date, this apology has not been announced, read, or publicized by the White House or by Congress. We don't teach a history of America, we teach a mythology. The mythology of America is that we are a nation that was discovered, we value equality, expansion, exceptionalism, and we have liberty and justice for all. That is the mythology of the United States of America. And that mythology runs very, very, very deep. Who here has been to the Lincoln Memorial? Keep your hands up. Who here has been to the museum at the base of the Lincoln Memorial? The base of the Lincoln Memorial, on the left-hand side, as you walk up to the memorial, there's a small museum the size of a small classroom. In this museum, on each wall are plaques about the size of a door with different writings and thoughts and ideas of President Lincoln and his legacy. On one of these walls, on the left-hand side, the south side of the room, there is this quote. It says, "I would save the Union. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union. It is not to save or destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that." At the base of the Lincoln Memorial, etched in stone, hanging on a wall, is a plaque that literally says, according to Abraham Lincoln, black lives don't matter. Now, I want to pause for just a second here. I realize I've given you a lot of history. There's probably a wave of emotions going on in you right now. I don't want a long discourse. I don't want long-winded answers. I want two or three words. There's no right or wrong answer. There's no good or bad answer. Emote to me. What's going on right now? Tell me what you're thinking. Tell me what you're feeling. Sadness. So right.
Unfair.
Disgust.
Shame.
Lament.
No reconciliation.
Hate. Tragedy.
Division.
Open our eyes. Yes.
Helplessness.
This is one of the challenges that we face as a nation, which is we don't teach our history, we teach a mythology. Instead of dehumanization, we teach discovery. Our equality is only for a select few. Instead of ethnic cleansing, we say expansion. Instead of genocide, we say exceptionalism. And we've never come to grips with the fact that the liberty and justice that's outlined in our founding documents only exists for white landowning men. We don't know what to do with this history. So how do we move forward? What do we do? Many nations have had what are called truth and reconciliation commissions, national dialogues about their history, a way to bring together these diverse and even battling parties to find a way to speak the truth and to seek reconciliation. South Africa, after the fall of apartheid, they had a truth and reconciliation commission. Rwanda, after this bloody civil war, had a truth and reconciliation. Canada, after a very expensive lawsuit brought by residential school survivors, came together and had a national truth and reconciliation commission. I'm convinced that as a nation, we need to have a national dialogue on race along the lines of a truth and reconciliation commission, but we have to make a few changes because the context of this word and the wording of this phrase doesn't make sense. Because in our context, the reconciliation we're talking about is racial. Now, race is not a genetic difference. It's a human construct. There's no distinguishable genetic difference of race. Race is a human construct. And in America, race was constructed for the purpose of oppressing and dividing. So the black race was constructed through what we call the one drop rule. What's the one drop rule? Well, if you have a single drop of African blood, you're black. Why do we have this rule? Because blacks were our labor force. The one drop rule allowed a white slave owner to rape his female slaves and produce more baby slaves. For Native Americans, for the American Indian, we had the blood quantum rule. What's the blood quantum rule? While you're full, you're half, you're a quarter, you're an eighth, you're a 16th, you're a 32nd, then you're bred out of existence. Why do we have this rule? Because the mythology of our nation is this land was discovered, it was empty, there was no one here. So we want as few natives as possible. So race is a human construct, and in America, it was constructed for the purpose of oppressing and dividing. Reconciliation implies a previous harmony. Clearly, that never existed. Racial reconciliation is a way, as a nation, we perpetuate the myth of America. Things used to be great, now they're falling apart. We do a lot of things to perpetuate the myth of our nation. I don't like the term racial reconciliation. I started using the term racial conciliation. Conciliation is merely the mediation of a dispute. Reconciliation lets us perpetuate the myth. Conciliation allows us to have a much more honest starting point. This thing started out bad. We're not trying to get back to a previous harmony. We're just trying to get to a better place than we are today. And so our nation doesn't need a National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We need a National Truth and Conciliation Commission. A national dialogue. Now, to prep our nation for this dialogue, there's four audiences that I want to engage with. The first audience is the church. The church has been in bed with the empire since Constantine. We wrote the doctrine of discovery. We have to take ownership of it. We have to acknowledge our complicity in it, and we need to lament it. My good friend Sung Chan Ra, he and I are writing a book on the doctrine of discovery called The Truth Be Told. And he talks about lament, and he says one aspect of lament is it's like being at a funeral dirge. There's a dead body in the casket. It's not coming back. The only thing you can do is weep. As a nation, as a church, we have hundreds, thousands of years of dead bodies in caskets. They're not going to come back to life. The only thing we can do is weep. The only thing we can do is lament and trust that the pattern we see with God throughout the scriptures is that when his people lament, God meets them there. God shows up. So my first audience, I want to convince the church that we need to go through a season of lament. My second audience is Native peoples. I want to convince our people that we are not the helpless victims of an oppressive colonial government. We are the host people of the land, and we have to begin acting into the role of host. I love what's happening at Standing Rock right now. I love what's happening, which is you see our Native peoples, our Native communities coming together and acting into, playing into the role of host, telling this nation that's obsessed with its economy and immediate returns on their investment, telling this nation that water is life. You cannot keep destroying your environment for the sake of your short-term economic goals. You can't drink oil. Trying to convince our nation, taking a lead in the conversation of we have to treat the environment differently. The third audience I want to engage with, and this is where I want to spend the next few minutes, is with communities of color. African Americans, Hispanic Americans, Asian Americans, even Native Americans. This is my message to our communities of color. Most of us have heard of what is called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. This is a version of trauma that you experience when you're on the receiving end, when you experience, when you witness violence. You have a condition called PTSD. There's another condition called historical trauma. So PTSD is an individual diagnosis. This person, that individual has PTSD. Historical trauma is how you understand the dissatisfaction in a broader community that's been oppressed. It's been proven to be passed down generation to generation through genetics, and it's how you understand the broader community. I refer to PTSD as a multi-generational communal manifestation of PTSD. So historical trauma is a multi-generational communal manifestation of PTSD. Does that make sense? Now there's another trauma called PITS that's being researched. PITS is perpetration-induced traumatic stress. PITS is like PTSD in every way, shape, and form, except instead of afflicting the person who received the violence, PITS afflicts the person who caused the violence. It comes out of this understanding by Socrates that the doer of injustice is more miserable than the sufferer. So I'm hypothesizing that if PTSD has a multi-generational communal manifestation that we call historical trauma, and we can see how our communities of color are suffering from historical trauma out of our history of the doctrine of discovery, then I'm hypothesizing that pits must also have a multi-generational communal manifestation, and that is the trauma that I identify white America is suffering from. Because you cannot build a nation on 500 years of dehumanizing injustice without traumatizing yourself. So my message to people of color is that white America is another group of traumatized people. So one of the first symptoms of trauma is shock and denial. When we understand white America as a group of traumatized people, it's easy to see their shock and denial. So this buried apology in the appropriations bill. This isn't racism. This is trauma. This is shock and denial. We have Texas and Oklahoma passing laws saying you can only teach patriotic history. This isn't racism. This is trauma. They're so overwhelmed by what they did to become who they are, they can't even teach it anymore. In fact, they're trying to remove the word slavery from their textbooks, because they can't believe what they're standing on. They can't even teach it anymore. Now, I want to go in a little more in depth here, because last summer, there was an experience of white trauma here on this very stage. The Christian Reformed Church was dealing with the doctrine of discovery. I was a member of a task force assigned by our synod to study, investigate, and try to engage a dialogue with the Christian Reformed Church on the doctrine of discovery. Now, I've worked with many denominations throughout the country trying to engage this conversation on the doctrine of discovery, and what I always ask denominations is, where is the touch point for your complicity in this doctrine? For the Methodists, it's this general that they had, this leader that they had at Sand Creek. For other denominations, the Catholics, it's when they ran boarding schools. And for Rehoboth, or for the Christian Reformed Church, our touch point with the doctrine of discovery is our mission to the Native peoples that we established in the 1900s at, we called Rehoboth, and the boarding school that we ran for almost 75, 80 years. This is the focal point of our trauma. And so in our report, we included in our report two stories of boarding school survivors. One of the stories was from a boarding school survivor from a BIA boarding school. The other story was from a boarding school survivor from Rehoboth. When our report got to the Board of Trustees, before it was released, they pulled the story of the Rehoboth boarding school survivor. It did not go forward with the full report. So when we got here to Synod and we discussed the doctrine of discovery, we passed a resolution where we acknowledge that the existing doctrine of discovery is heresy, and we reject and condemn it. It helped shape Western culture and led to great injustices. This is a very good resolution that we passed. But then if you were here, we then almost immediately went into a 20-minute sharing time about how great our boarding school was and all the blessings that came out of it. And then we passed a resolution that said that Synod nevertheless recognized also the gospel motivation in response to the Great Commission, as well as the love and grace extended over many years by missionaries sent out by the CRCNA to the indigenous peoples of Canada and the United States. For this, we give God thanks and honor their dedication. You can't do that. You can't reject and condemn the doctrine of discovery and label it as heresy and then deny that you were involved with that. You can't do it. That's shock and denial. That's an example of the trauma of white America. We don't know what to do with our history. We don't know how to acknowledge what happened and what took place and the history that we're standing on. We don't know how to talk about it. White America is another group of traumatized people. And we have to understand that as people of color if we are going to engage this dialogue. Now, another touch point of our trauma, and I'm going to go a few minutes over, this is, I'm getting in a little bit in depth here, is American exceptionalism. I identify American exceptionalism as the coping mechanism for a nation in deep denial of its genocidal past as well as its current racist reality. We don't know what to do with the doctrine of discovery. We don't know what to do that our land titles are based on the dehumanization of people of color. We don't know what to do with the fact that our history is a history of ethnic cleansing and genocide. And so we cope with that by telling ourselves we're exceptional. We have a manifest destiny. We have a special relationship with God. This myth runs so deep that almost two years ago, March 3rd, 2015, Benjamin Netanyahu was speaking to a joint session of our Congress. He was here lobbying against the Iran nuclear deal that the White House was negotiating. And he was speaking to a very divided, very partisan Congress. And he had to get both sides behind him. So at the beginning of his speech, he said to our Congress, because America and Israel, we share a common destiny, the destiny of promised lands. I wanted to scream. The United States of America is not God's chosen people. Do any of you believe for a moment that the Prime Minister of Israel thinks that you and I share in the sacred covenant his people have with the God of Abraham? Do any of you believe for a moment that the Prime Minister of Israel believes you and I are the manifestation of the new Israel and this is our promised land and God has blessed us and provided for us here? Or is he merely a very savvy politician who understands all too well the trauma of his audience and knows what they need to hear? American exceptionalism is the coping mechanism of a nation in deep denial of its genocidal past. We have a very dysfunctional and codependent relationship with the nation state of Israel. We need their history of taking possession of Canaan and ethnically cleansing their promised land to justify our genocide of native peoples. And they need our mythology of a manifest destiny and the new Israel to justify their current oppression of the Palestinian people. The United States and Israel have a very dysfunctional and codependent relationship that is all intertwined in this modern outliving of promised lands and manifest destiny. And it's very, very, very unhealthy. Now, when you deal with trauma patients have what are called triggers. A trigger is something that takes you out of reality and back into the chaos of the moment of when the trauma occurred. So if you understand white America as another group of traumatized people, it's easy to see their triggers. So two terms of a black president is a trigger. For 8 years, seeing someone governing from the Oval Office instead of building the Oval Office has traumatized our nation. Without President Obama, we never elect Donald Trump. It doesn't happen. It's a trigger. Any sort of national dialogue on gun control is a trigger. White America cannot have this conversation without screaming at each other. ISIS is a trigger. Why is ISIS a trigger? Well, they're a group of religious zealots ethnically cleansing a land to set up their own pseudo-religious empire. We don't know what to do with that. That reflection is so familiar, it just freaks us out. This is why Paris got bombed and we somehow made it all about us. The Standing Rock Sioux, the Dakota Access Pipeline, is a trigger. When you have a nation that's built on the extermination of an entire group of people, when you see those people come together, even though it's in solidarity for peaceful protest, prayer, and ceremony, that's terrifying.
and it elicits response like this. Our nation doesn't know what to do with its history. Now, why do I refer to this as trauma? Because in most racial dialogues, white America is either racist or they're fragile. Neither one of those are helpful. If white America is racist, if you are racist just because you're white, there's no room for them in the dialogue. That's not helpful. If white America is fragile, it means we have to walk around on eggshells. We have to smooth things over for them. By understanding white America is traumatized, what I am trying to do is to create a space for the reaction that we get from the dominant culture without giving them control of the situation. When you're a counselor and you're dealing with a patient who's traumatized and they begin freaking out, you say, this is good, you're making a connection. You're freaking out over something and it's not the right thing, but you're making a connection and you're finally connecting your emotions and reality in some way, and you try to build on that. But you don't get in there and mix it up with your patient. You don't start slugging it out with them because you understand that their trauma is making them upset about something besides you, even though it's venting and coming towards you. I'm trying to help us understand the reactions that we see from white America so that we don't give them control, but we do create a space where we can actually have the conversation. And we need to have the conversation. We need to find a way to talk about these things. There's something I want to end with. There's an Aboriginal leader named George Erasmus. And he says, where common memory is lacking, where people don't share in the same past, there can be no real community. If you want to build community, you have to start by creating a common memory. I love this quote. This quote gets to the heart of our nation's problem with race, which is we don't have a common memory. We have a dominant culture that has a memory of discovery, expansion, exceptionalism, and opportunity, and we have communities of color that have the lived experience of stolen lands, broken treaties, slavery, ethnic cleansing, Jim Crow laws, boarding schools, internment camps. There's no common memory. We have to find a way to create this. We need to have a national dialogue on race. We need to find a way to deal with the truth of our history so that we can move forward and create a better community. We don't need racial reconciliation. We need racial conciliation. And that is what I want to invite you into. I want to invite you into understanding our history, sitting in this moment, learning how to lament, feeling this uncomfortability, and finding a way to talk about it. Because until we learn how to do that, we're going to continue to go our separate ways, to be divisive, and even to self-destruct and to destroy one another. Thank you very much.
We have just a few minutes for questions. If you'd like to write them on paper and wave them, ushers will bring them up to me. If you'd like to tweet them or email them, you can do so. Some have come in already. I'm reminded, as you talk about the need to have truth and reconciliation commissions and activities, I'm reminded of Brian Stevenson, who spoke here a few years ago, who talks about just the need to listen and acknowledge the reality of oppression. Until we have a national conversation, how can we as individuals and as neighbors and as congregation members, how can we begin this conversation, and how, and I ask for myself, how do you advise us to listen without a defensive posture?
One of the things that I encourage audiences to do is we still today live under this myth that our nation was discovered. Mm-hmm. We don't ask who were the people who were on this land before I came here. I encourage audiences to find out who are the people who were ethnically cleansed so that you could buy the house you're living in today. What treaties were written? What treaties were broken? What was the history of this land before this nation came into existence? And then to find ways to build relationship with those people. Many people tell me all over the country that, well, I don't know the history of natives because there's none around me. And I say, yeah, that's by design. Your country was designed for the purpose of you would never have to deal with the people who lived on this land before you got here. That's the way our nation was constructed. And so if you want to build those relationships, if you want to engage those conversations, you have to go out of your way in order to seek those out. And so I encourage people, until we get to this point of a national dialogue on race, that we need to begin to build these relationships, to learn this history, and to sit in this history for a while so that we can understand how we're going to move forward to get to a better place.
How does one find others who celebrate those who celebrate talking about things most of us will not talk about? Well put.
Not through Facebook. So one of the things that I encourage people to do is, even after events like this, and I often tell people that after an event like this, after I come in and I lay out this history that is shocking and surprising and uncomfortable for most people, it literally takes people about 6 months to get to a point where they can actually talk about it. You're still in this state of shock. You're like, I don't know what to do with all this. I don't know how to process all this. Some of my best conversations have been with audiences and individuals that heard me speak 6 to 9 months ago. And then I come back, and they say, you know what, ever since I heard you speak, I haven't been able to put this out of my mind. I've been processing through this. And then we go into a very good dialogue about what does this mean to move forward. And so even after sessions like this, I encourage audiences is find people who are here and have some similar convictions and just devote yourself to understanding more of this history. I just gave the tip of the iceberg today. There is a lot more history, a lot more specifics that we didn't have time to cover. And so I encourage people just to share this with each other, to find books to read, find out who is the tribe that lived in your area, learn their oral history, learn their written history, and begin to educate yourself with a group of friends who are similarly convicted.
A related question from a student. I'm studying to be an elementary school teacher. I'll be teaching American history to young Americans from a variety of backgrounds and life situations. Do you have any advice about how best to teach truth to these young ones while curriculum and textbooks may gloss over the traumatic and systemically racist events of the past?
Yeah, I encourage teachers all the time to identify to their students when their textbooks are lying to them. When they use terms like expansion, we need to identify that as ethnic cleansing and genocide. When they use terms like discovery, we have to help them. You can't discover lands already inhabited. We have to find the ways that our textbooks have, through this trauma, have glossed over this history. And even if you don't know all the knowledge, to go back and teach this and that, and there's resources out there you can find, both on my website as well as others out there, but to not allow your students to be fed the perpetuation of the lie or the myth that this land was discovered, that we just expanded, without dealing with what does that actually mean. I've actually had the opportunity to talk with both elementary, junior high, and high school classes, and I find most students are incredibly resilient to hearing this history and are able to grapple with it. And when we can get it into their minds at a young age, that's going to shape the way they think about our nation and how we need to address these problems as they get older and move forward.
Do you think it's possible for churches in America to spread the gospel through missions without forcing cultural assimilation?
Yes.
Good.
But it's hard. One of the things I say to churches frequently is the worst manifestations of the doctrine of discovery is the ethnic cleansing, the genocide, the boarding schools, all the things that we do. But most of our churches have mission agencies that are built on this belief, this implicit bias, that natives, people of color, are less than human, and we are going out to humanize the subhumans. And that's often the mentality we have as our mission teams. And it's not explicit, it's very subtle. So we go out with huge groups, right, of untrained builders to build a house that none of us would ever live in, but we're building it for other people to live in. We go out with these huge teams that none of the people we're visiting will ever have a chance of inviting them into their homes, of getting to know them. And so I encourage people, if you really want to do missions, if you really want to work with diverse peoples and hurting peoples around the nation, you need to go out in a way that you can start by building a relationship. And as you work on that relationship, then you can find ways of how can we walk alongside you in moving forward. But to come in with our colonial mindset of missions, where every missionary, you either go somewhere and you build something, you teach something, or you give something away, and you don't go there for the purpose of building relationship. We have to change our mission mindset, where the primary focus of our missions is about building relationship.
I'm going to ask one last question, and then Mark Charles will be out in the front lobby to greet you all afterwards, and I thank you for coming. But I want to land on this one. Where do you find hope? Here's a question. Standing up against racism, exhausting and sometimes dangerous. How do you rejuvenate yourself when you're constantly partaking? So where do you find hope?
So I find hope ultimately, I find my hope in Christ, and that I see the model that he put forward was a model of building relationship. It wasn't a model of colonialism. You know, this Sunday I'm preaching at the Church of the Servant, mm-hmm. and I'm going to be preaching from Luke 9. And Luke 9, verse 51 through 56, the disciples have just been rejected by the Samaritans, the disciples and Jesus, and they come to Jesus and say, okay, Jesus, so should we call down fire on them and destroy them? And Jesus is like, no, we're not doing that anymore. You know, it's like he rebukes them. And Jesus is when we think about Christian empire, we think about this colonial mindset of doing missions. And Jesus allowed the Samaritans to reject him and didn't feel like, no, I have to now punish them for that. He let them go on and coexist alongside of himself. I am so convinced God created a beautiful and diverse world. The truth, I believe, is found in Jesus, but it's not we have to pummel people into submission to find this truth. We can present it and they can believe it or not believe it, but we can still accept them as people. We can still walk alongside them as people and as cohabitants of this earth and try to find a way that we can coexist in this world without me having to pummel them into submission to believe my truths or having them pummel me into submission to believe their truths. And so the hope that I have is the model that I see in Jesus and the way that he was able to present truth but also do it in a way that expressed a deep love and concern for the people that he was engaging with.
Thank you. Before you applaud, what time is church really? We just changed times. 9:30? 9:30. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Bless you.